Simon Blackburn is a Professor of Philosophy and a Fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge. He is known for his work on quasi-realism and is widely regarded as one of the world's leading philosophers. What is truth, or at least how can we come to think of it?
What is truth is famously Pilate's question. I'm faced with the conflicting views about who Jesus was and what he'd done. The predominant views until recently have been that there ought to be an answer to Pilate's question, an interesting answer. And the standout candidate was always the correspondence theory of truth. Truth consists in correspondence with the facts. As far as I'm aware, the first serious challenges to this, I think there'd always been grumbles that somehow it seemed a fairly useless thing to say because it swapped one problem for another. It swapped the problem of what's truth, the problem of what's a fact. And facts are funny kind of things. You can't weigh them, you can't put them in a bucket, you can't kick them. Facts, for example, aren't structures. They can't be moved. Wittgenstein has a nice example of this. He says that you could move the Eiffel Tower from Paris to Berlin, if you were so minded. Couldn't move the fact that the Eiffel Tower is in Paris anywhere. That fact just stays put. You can destroy that fact. You can stop it being true that the Eiffel Tower is in Paris, but you can't move the fact or pick it up. And so facts are not quite like things. Nevertheless, correspondence theory tries to say that there is a relation between whatever it is we say and the world, and that's the relation of truthfulness, if we're lucky, or truth, if we're lucky, if we get things right. I think the first serious dislike of the theory came from, well, first of all, the great German logician Gottlob Frege, and following him, quite a slew of writers in the 20th century. Until now, the story I'm about to mention is kind of orthodox, and this is the story known as deflationism, which says that Pilate was asking the wrong question. Or at least, if he asked that question, the only possible answer was to throw it back at him by saying, "What are you interested in?" And then suppose Pilate says, "Well, I'm interested in the truth about whether this guy has been supporting or fomenting a rebellion." Then the only answer is a very banal one, which is that, well, it's true that he's been fomenting a rebellion, if and only if he's been fomenting a rebellion. It's up to you to judge whether that's true. But that's just judging whether he's fomented a rebellion, which you can set about doing in, you know, a variety of historical ways. So somehow the notion of truth seems to efface itself. It seems to drop out. And in fact, the first name for what's now called deflationism was the redundancy theory of truth. And that was particularly associated with the great British logician Frank Ramsey, who was a friend of Russell and Wittgenstein.
Essentially, aspects of deflationism try to move away from this kind of abstract notion of truth and concentrate much more on concrete or at least empirically verifiable aspects of truth. Yes. I think you said at the top of the discussion there, which is very important, which is the constitution of a fact, which to some people would seem a bit strange, but what is a fact is very hard to define and constitutes. There's been a lot of work in this area. So from my perspective, say a famous school from the early 20th century, which was the critical theory school in Frankfurt, had this problem with fact-value distinction, that it wasn't so clear-cut. Others have made this point as well. But one thing just in everyday general conversation that people would have a trouble understanding this would be, it's a fact that the Earth goes around the Sun. How do we reconcile stuff that is quite clearly a fact with stuff that may not necessarily be a fact?
Good. Well, you're absolutely right that the Frankfurt School, amongst others, came to despair of sharp distinctions here, fact-value distinctions, empirical, theoretical, observation versus theory, perhaps even language versus non-linguistic fact. The as William James very aptly said, the trail of the human serpent lies over everything. So you're right, the distinctions start to wobble. But I think our everyday distinction has something to do with, first of all, causation. There seem to be facts to which we are causally much better plugged in than others. If I stub my toe on a brick, the fact that I've hit a brick is not in dispute. It's not going to be disputed by anyone, let alone by me. It's a given, as it were, or the nearest thing to a given that we can imagine. Other so-called facts are much more problematic because we don't have a unified or certain way of getting to convergence of opinion on them. And, of course, primary amongst those are valuations, where a plurality of views, diversity of views, is, as it were, the human condition. So there's no similar way of getting a convergence. There's nothing that corresponds to a so-called verification procedure, which all parties can agree on, and if you plug it in, then out comes the answer, yes or no. And those are the areas where factuality seems sort of in question much more. And, of course, those were the areas that interested the Frankfurt School. They were interested in social interpretation and social judgment.
Essentially, an argument to be made that even though we can have facts or causal events occurring and aren't disputable on one level, at the same time, it's the underpinning value of that fact that might cause contentious fallouts.
Yes, exactly. Sure, you could think that's fine. That's where science takes us, but it must have been God snapping his fingers that made the thing happen in the first place. Yes, absolutely.
So, for example, Big Bang inflationary model, one can be a physicist about it and be an atheist and still have the same fact and believe that it's still the creation of a God.
Yes, exactly. Sure, you could think that's fine. That's where science takes us, but it must have been God snapping his fingers that made the thing happen in the first place. Yes, absolutely.
Simon, you've given us a very good run through quickly from different versions of truth, but as your previously published book now nearly 10 years ago on truth, what do you think are fundamental elements in truth when we consider this thing? What would Simon Blackburn say?
Well, I think I'd start from a deflationist standpoint, but then I'd start to worry what might be objections to that and what might need adding to that. So do we have to tweak it? I'll give you a couple of examples of objections, or at least hurdles, perhaps I should say, that have to be overcome. One is that we use, although Ramsey was right, that there's no difference between saying it's true that I've just hit my toe on a brick and I've just hit my toe on a brick. Those two come to the same. The notion of truth is redundant there. There are contexts in which it's not redundant. So, for example, if I tell you every proposition is either true or false, something logicians like to say, you can't get rid of the notion of truth or falsity from that sentence. It seems to be essentially about truth or falsity. And you can't substitute just every sentence or something else. That makes no sense. You've got to have is true or is false. The standard reply to that on behalf of deflationists is very important, and it says, look, the predicate is true itself serves as a, sometimes said, a device of generalization. And that sounds a bit sort of, tricky. What that means is that it's there precisely to collect together instances where we don't have to mention truth, but to collect them together, we need a word like is true. Let me give you a simpler example. Suppose I tell you, I've just had breakfast with our friend Johnny, and I tell you everything Johnny said at breakfast is true. Well, that's all very well, but I don't tell you what he said. What I do tell you is that what he said was true. What do you take away from that? Well, in a way, you take away a disposition which stands you in the following position. If you learn that Johnny said P at breakfast, then P. If you learn that Johnny said that George Bush believes that Canada is south of the United States, then you learn that, if you believe that everything Johnny said at breakfast is true, you learn that George Bush said that Canada was south of the United States, which is probably not the worst mistake he ever made. And if you learn that George Bush said that, you know, cats bark, then you learn that George Bush said that cats bark. And if you learn that George Bush said any of an infinite number of other things, you're in a position to assert those other things, as long as you go on believing that everything George Bush said at breakfast was true. Yeah, was that right? I should have said everything George Bush said at breakfast was false. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. It's the same issue. So what logicians got to realize was that the notion of truth has this sort of generalizing or collective function, collecting together function. It enables us to make remarks about whole bunches of propositions, even if we don't know what those propositions are. And that can be very valuable, can give us, as it were, another part of our picture of the world. So redundancy got kicked out. People said it's not redundant in every context. But nevertheless, it's not reintroducing a robust, metaphysical, tricky relation between propositions and things. It's simply giving us a way of generalizing over all the propositions that we might be interested in.
Also, isn't it going to be slightly problematic because certain elements regarding truth and logic are by definition true? So 2 and 2 is 4 by definition. Does that cause a further problem when we talk about truth and logic?
Well, certainly it does. I mean, there's an awful lot of philosophy gone under the bridge. I mean, we can't really, I think, talk about all the arguments that have gone. Sorry, I was just getting a CD out of my computer, putting another one in and making some copies. We can't get into all the arguments that have swelled around this one, but certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, or for the first 30 years or so, a lot of philosophers believed in a very sharp distinction between propositions, which are sometimes called analytic, and they're trivial, they're thought of as being true by definition, they're linguistically true. They're, as it were, part of the just how we define things to be. And propositions which have a more chunky and robust content. The first ones are called analytic, the second family is called synthetic. And nearly everybody believed in the analytic-synthetic distinction. Along came the great American philosopher Willard Quine of Harvard, who put the cat amongst the pigeons by challenging that distinction. You mentioned right at the beginning that many distinctions get undermined and overthrown in philosophy, and this is one of them. He said, you know, if you look at the way science puts together its assertions to make up a theory, you don't find a division between what's a matter of definition and what's a matter of substantial fact. If you look at, say, Newton's laws of motion, there's no way of separating out those which are factual and those which are purely definitional. The definition and the facts sort of intermingle. So that was a very important new kid on the block, which both prompted a lot of argument and also prompted a lot of rethinking about the place of the analytic-synthetic distinction. It had existed in its form until then, since the time of Kant.
Within this, if I can just get you to comment on the areas of causation and explanation that go along with this, because obviously a problem just as complicated as truth in philosophy is a causation with different views throughout history. Obviously Hume's a very famous for kind of essentially negating an intrinsic view of causation, and the logical positivists that you're partly referring to there in the early 20th century also had that view. But lately causation, the second half of the 20th century, has come back into vogue a bit more. Well, if you look at the 70s and 80s, someone like Nancy Cartwright and Ian Hacking. But yeah. With those terms in mind, because really in everyday terminology. So sometimes we don't want philosophy to be so abstract, and that's a good thing about deflationist views on truth. But how does truth tie in when we say that if something calls something, then surely it's true, and surely it explains why it's true? But it isn't necessarily always the case, especially within realism and anti-realism. But if you could just tackle truth, causation, and explanation as well, please, Simon. Within this, if I can just get you to comment on the areas of causation and explanation that go along with this, because obviously a problem just as complicated as truth in philosophy is a causation with different views throughout history. Obviously Hume's very famous for essentially negating an intrinsic view of causation, and the logical positivists that you're partly referring to there in the early 20th century also had that view. But lately causation, the second half of the 20th century, has come back into vogue a bit more. Well, if you look at the 70s and 80s, someone like Nancy Cartwright and Ian Hacking. But with those terms in mind, because really in everyday terminology, so sometimes we don't want philosophy to be so abstract, and that's a good thing about deflationist views on truth. But how does truth tie in when we say that if something calls something, then surely it's true, and surely it explains why it's... But this isn't necessarily always the case, especially within realism and anti-realism. But if you could just tackle truth, causation, and explanation as well, please, Simon.
Well, this again opens, as you well realise, a very good question. I think, you know, one of the ways of making people sensitive to the difficulty in the notion of a fact is to take something like the fact, as we think of as being, that A causes B. And if you ask what we observe when we observe that A causes B, and you know how we know about it, we're very rapidly led down Hume's path. David Hume, who's, as you rightly say, the first to sort of really critique this notion, and he says, well, really, all you're observing is one thing after another. You're observing a succession of events. However, if the events fall into a pattern, they're a type of event where every event of the first kind seems to be followed by an event of the second kind, then we get a habit of the mind, which is roughly, we both are certain that the second kind of event will happen as the first kind of event happens. We predict it with, you know, conviction, and we're prepared to use the first kind of event to as a recipe in order to manipulate the world to bring about the second kind of event and then make the second kind of event happen. So we get a kind of practical technique in our repertoire. And then Hume asked, well, what else is there to causation? And he found there was no answer. People think in terms of a necessary connection between events. But Hume argued that there's nothing really to causation except our habit of expectation and manipulation of the world. We use the notion of causation because we are practical animals. We do things. We need recipes for constructing outcomes. And if we didn't, if we just sat passively observing the world, all we'd actually see is just one damn thing after another. And we wouldn't have the habits of mind that lead us to hive off the causal connections between things from just mere regularity of occurrence.
The David Hume aspect is of be cautious of how we observe regularities in the world. But in the later part of the 20th century, most philosophers now do talk of causation. So when it ties into explanation, what can we say about this?
Well, from my perspective, I think there is a sort of modern rush to what's sometimes called causal realism. From my perspective, I think it's a bit of a mistake. I think a lot of philosophers underestimate the strength of Hume's position and underestimate the strength of the difficulties he put in the way or found in the way of the notion of causation. So I think people are... there's been a general return to metaphysics in contemporary philosophy, and this is an example of it. That whereas, say, even 30 years ago, certainly 40 years ago, most people would have been somewhere on Hume's side on this. I mean, you know, there were divisions, of course, and questions of interpretation, but basically the sort of Humean approach to causation was pretty dominant. now people are sort of less bothered about talking of things like causal laws, laws of nature, laws governing the universe, laws governing when one event happens, must another one happen. And I think that's a pity. I think it's fine for for scientists simply to announce that they found the law of nature, or they found a necessity that if one thing happens, another thing must happen. But it's up to the philosopher to give an account of what's been said when you say that, and that's when the difficulties start.
For sure. I mean, as you said, there's been an approach back towards general metaphysical pictures in philosophy. No one really questions as much as they used to whether there is a true causal element involved there. To a certain extent, it's sometimes assumed. But I mean, a lot of people still to this day would give Hume some kind of warrant in that, especially with the problems of inductive logic and also still the Kantian aspect of being separated. You can never perhaps know phenomena in themselves. That's still quite dominant in that respect. When we talk about these elements of truth and explanation in realism and anti-realism, how do these come about in analytic philosophy, philosophy of science, and your work on quasi-realism?
Right. Well, quasi-realism follows on naturally from Hume's account of causation. Hume gave us a rather surprising picture of what we're doing when we talk about causal necessities, about one object causing another, one outcome has to occur if some previous outcome occurs. He said that it's us who are inventing or imposing these necessities on things. This sounds actually very like Kant, who said something similarly, thought the mind did it. So it's part of an old battle about what's down to the world and what's down to the mind. That's like the battle about facts. What's down to the world, what's purely factual, and what's down to our interpretations of the world, or the machinery that we bring to the world, our cognitive apparatus, our emotional apparatus, and so on. So this is all part of that kind of dispute in philosophy, if you like. The people who are brought, who are, as it were, inclined to see the world as doing it all, are sometimes called realists. I think the facts are just there, and it's not just to pick them up. People verging the other way go under a variety of titles. They're sometimes thought of as skeptics, particularly by realists. But I think better titles include things like social constructivists, pragmatists, and in my case, so-called quasi-realist. Now, the quasi-realist that I invented was somebody who basically sympathizes with the pragmatist or social constructivist, sometimes called expressivist, kind of outlook. So in the case of causation, for example, they'd sympathize with Hume, but doesn't draw the conclusion that therefore we are going around making a mistake, we shouldn't talk as we do about necessary connections, we should reform and revise our language or purify our ways of thinking. The quasi-realist says, no, our ways of thinking are fine. There's nothing wrong with the linguistic forms or the cognitive structures that we use. It's just that it's not quite as it appears. There's a sort of background Humean story, but it's with that background Humean story that you can go on and talk in many respects, like the realist. You don't have to give everything up. So let me give you an example. I think that when we do ethics, we're basically in the business of expressing an attitude. We're sharing attitudes and things like prohibitions, encouragements, we're badgering people, we're seeking to put pressures on behavior and so on. So it's essentially practical. And there's a sort of philosopher who says, oh, well, if that's all that's going on, then we can't, as it were, worry about whether we're getting our ethics right, because we've lost the facts. We've got no facts. We've just got a kind of battle of sentiments. And, it's rather like I like mint toothpaste and you don't. There's no real fact of the matter that we're disputing about. And so it might seem, therefore, that we ought to give up saying things like, I think there ought to be a minimum wage, but I'm not sure that I'm right about that. Because that would imply that there's something to be right or wrong about. And this, according to the critic, the expressivist has lost that. Well, what I came along and said was, no, the critic's wrong. The expressivist is right about, as it were, what's going on. But given that we're in the business of attitude, it doesn't follow that we accept that all attitudes are equally to be adopted. I may be very firm that there should be a minimum wage. Ian Duncan Smith may be very firm that there shouldn't be a minimum wage. We've then got to discuss. You've actually got to try to come to a resolution. And it's because we have this need to try to come to a resolution. I want my view to prevail. He wants his view to prevail. Well, one thing we can do is try and lock the other guy up. That's the resort to force. But as long as we're in the business of discussion, we need a language to discuss it. And the language we've got does that perfectly. I say, I'm sorry, Ian, I'm afraid you're wrong about that, and try and argue him out of his position. He can do the same to me. So arguing as if there's a right or wrong here, which it's our business to hit upon, seems to me a justifiable activity, and it's one that our ordinary language is very well adapted to. So the quasi-realist was, as it were, somebody who has the expressivist or pragmatist or union starting point, but isn't quite as radical as saying, so let's chuck the baby out with the bathwater. Let's get rid of all our, you know, bad ways of thinking. So that's the deal.
So it's by recognising that we have got subjective values that are in play, but then talking or at least expressing them out through attitudes and essentially a solid argumentation which is present for all history and language, which is a reasonable way to at least come to some kind of agreement or conclusion on statements that don't necessarily depend on any kind of factual distinction, but you still want to argue your value and attitude.
That's right. You still want to argue the toss. You still want to come to a coordination or an agreement, or you want to sway the audience. There's a lot of persuasion involved. I think Fox Hunting ought to be banned, and Roger Scruton thinks Fox Hunting is great. You know, we each have a debate. We have a debate about it. I will try and put Fox Hunting in a bad light. He'll try and put it in a good light. And there's a great deal, of course, of persuasion involved. It's not quite like doing science. But it's very like doing politics, where equally there's a lot of persuasion involved.
Definitely very political in that sense. We've talked about how there's issues in establishing elements of causation, explanation, and how these relate to the different elements of realism in analytic philosophy. Now, with this, you've already touched upon it as well, with social constructivism that came along, also elements of postmodernism and post-structuralism. Now, a classic in this field would be people like Foucault, Derrida, which still deals with truth, but in a separate way, because you can still see that someone like Kant, and in the continental tradition, someone like Heidegger, but essentially started off in the social sciences and in the humanities, that these elements such as this is justice, this is right, wrong, are outcomes of power and knowledge that are exercised. And that's a very postmodernist way of saying that these conceptual forms that we have, that we claim represent reality, are really just socially constructed.
Yes.
Now, that's quite clearly ties in with what you were saying about the different forms of truth argumentation throughout history. But when we take them on that side, it's easy to see how this can play out in a political, social manner. But when it comes again to empiricism and actual verifying data, people have again take a step back by going, okay, I can understand someone saying that justice is socially constructed, but when I say that's a particle. From your idea, would the best way to approach that be again to just rely on some of the tenets from what Kant taught us, what Hume's taught us, and what realism and anti-realism and quasi-realism taught us? How would you approach this?
Well, of course, again, we're touching on very big things. I think the high point of, as it were, the postmodernist. Well, let me back up on that. I think it's valuable. You mentioned some of the great figures in the continental tradition. I think it's valuable to remember a slightly different conception of the philosopher that has often, you know, infused the so-called continental tradition. And this is the role of the philosopher in social and political affairs. The continent has been far more sensitive than England has to the role of ideology. I mean, they've seen it in action. So, for example, the English being sort of, I don't know, cold-blooded and dispassionate, at least for the last 250 years, we didn't take the Enlightenment to justify a revolution. We didn't have a terror at the end of the 18th century. And I think we've been quite insensitive to the role of ideology in a way that continental philosophers have been acutely sensitive to it. And by ideology, I mean a kind of prevailing atmosphere of ideas. I mean, we're becoming more sensitive to it now. People are beginning to notice that the domination of, for example, market ideas, ideas of the market, ideas of the value of the market, ideas of the way everything ought to be marketized. That was the ideology which came in the Thatcher years in the late 1970s and lasted till 2008. And it may still go on, it probably does, certainly does in government. But people have become sensitive to the fact that that's actually just one way of looking at social life, and it's not necessarily a very good way. So in a sense, we're being pulled towards the continent. They've always had that kind of critique on their hands. When it comes to science, probably the nearest thing to, you know, a transfer of these ideas to science was heralded in the work of Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in 1961. And taken a bit further by some of his followers like Imre Lakatos of the LSE and Paul Feyerabend especially, who's a very radical critique of science, and some French thinkers too. I find its application to science quite tricky, and you get, let's put it this way, suppose you say that somebody's idea of justice is conditioned by an ideology, is conditioned by their place in the patriarchy or their class, their place in the class system or the nature of the historical moment. You can see how that might be true. If you say somebody's idea of a particle is conditioned by those things, I think the right response is just to scratch your head and say, well, you know, what are the alternatives? You know, if you're a good enough physicist to think of alternatives, well, put them out in the marketplace of ideas and see what happens. But if you can't think of alternatives, it seems to me kind of whistling in the wind to go around, you know, like Sherlock Holmes looking for clues. And you may find it very difficult to find them. And that's true, say, in mathematics. You could say, for example, that there ought to be a feminist mathematics. Well, fine, go away and make some new mathematical moves and see if you can actually make a contribution to the overall structure of mathematical thinking. If you can, that's fine. And if you can argue that those moves were hidden because there was a male-dominated subject and there weren't enough women in it, well and good. But until you made the moves, people are going to go on saying, look, 2 plus 2 is 4. I don't care about your alleged feminist mathematics. Unless you're going to unseat some of my views or add new mathematics to my views, your commentary is kind of idle. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people eventually went back to thinking that the commentary of people like Kuhn, Feyerabend, and a Lacatoche, yes. And in the French tradition, famously Bruno Latour, who's been a philosopher of science, who made very radical pronouncements about how science is all conditioned by this and that. I think the high tide of that view has kind of started to recede, and people go back to saying, "Well, my iPad works, so I'm going to thank the scientists. They seem to get things right."
Well, last time I was on a plane, it didn't crash at ETC. That's exactly right. But I think some of the stuff there that you mentioned speaks straight to the heart of some of the notions we've been dealing with here in terms of truth and reality, which is this kind of undercurrent between universality and contextualization or relativity that some of the postmodernists would like to say. So, as you said, at first, Thomas Kuhn was obviously a great philosophical work with a lot of followers. And obviously the notion of a paradigm collapsing had a lot of consequences with it. So he believes, and well, in certain areas, he believes that it's no longer viable, obviously, to speak about the past because it's a different paradigm. So those terms don't mean anything anymore. And then some, which is probably now the more commonplace, say, okay, we can redefine some of those processes we had in the past, but it's still aspects of materialism that we can measure with mathematics and verify. So there's still some kind of truth there, but to a certain extent, this is a kind of separate area here in philosophy of science, but it still speaks to what you've been saying as well about this kind of what can we do universally with truth and reality and the epistemic and ontological consequences of it, which is very interesting. I'm sure as obviously there's feminist and Marxist work in the oppression of science, and also the sociology of science, which has some very interesting theories, but whether you want to follow them or not is a separate issue. For example, there's been work, I believe, in the early 80s, which was essentially that no way would the quark have been designed if it wasn't for social constructivist approaches, which is, and I'm not sure, most physicists said they've detected something similar to that in a lab, but it speaks to the heart of realism and materialism in terms of what can you do with observable, unobservable entities. So very problematic. Whilst I've got you here though, Simon, what do you think going forward would be some of the hot topics to research when we talk about truth?
Well, I think there's an enormous, I think, when I started my career in philosophy in the 1960s, there was a lot of compartmentalization. So philosophy of language, or semantic theory, which is where people sat who talked about truth, was certainly in analytical philosophy, a fairly specialist branch of the subject. It was dominated in large part by some quite technical issues to do with formal languages, the definition of truth in formal languages, work of the great Polish logician Tarski, and so on. And so it was quite compartmentalized, and semantic theory was a really quite a specialist branch of philosophy, even of philosophy of language. Now there's far more permeable boundaries or no boundaries at all. So you get much more interchange between cognitive science, philosophy of mind, general philosophical issues, and anything that might be interesting to say about truth. So I think the cages have gone, and I think that's a thoroughly good thing. So you might think about truth now, thinking about our general capacity for judgment, and you might be working with psychologists and cognitive scientists on that as much as good old-fashioned philosophers of language. And I think that's a thoroughly good thing. Evolutionary psychology gets a look in. If you're a philosopher of truth now, you probably do well to look at works on the evolution of language. I see that as a wave of the future. I think that there's going to be a lot more interchange between biologists, evolutionary theorists, cognitive scientists, and philosophers. So I think that's a very good thing.
Sure. So a far more interdisciplined approach coming forward.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, there's still a lot to master in any particular discipline. There's quite a lot of philosophy to know about before you start chatting to your colleagues in other departments. So I'm not in favour of just a sort of smorgasbord education. But I am in favour of everyone talking to everyone else.
Simon, is there anything on your specific research agenda, any papers, publications that you're working on at the moment?
Yes, I'm quite interested in the extent to which things that I've said about ethics, that's in connection with the quasi-realist sort of project, plug into the general philosophical stream known as pragmatism. Mm-hmm. And that's taken me back to look at the work of people like William James, Charles Peirce, John Dewey, and more recently people like Richard Rorty, who like to call themselves pragmatists, Wilfred Sellers, Richard Rorty. And there's quite a little school now developed. Some of the names include Bob Brandon at Pittsburgh, Hugh Price in Cambridge, and Michael Williams at Rockefeller. And there's a bunch of people who have picked up what they take to be the pragmatist element in often Wilfred Sellers, sometimes Wittgenstein in my own case, and are trying to weld a theory out of that.